Next up on This Week in Law, the crew from New Media Rights joins us. That is Art Neal, Terry Karabonic, and our shared intern, Emery Roan. We'll talk about the $25 million infringement verdict against ISP Cox, Star Wars and the DMCA, and a visit from ugly holiday sweater Darth Vader is in store for you as well. Please join us.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson, episode 331, recorded December 18th, 2015. I find your lack of safe harbor protection disturbing. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/twill. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to BlueApron.com/twit. That's BlueApron.com/twit. Hi, folks. Happy holidays. It's Denise Howell here with our final episode of This Week in Law for 2015. And we're going out with a bang. We've got a great panel for you. So excited to have back on the show. New Media Rights is in the house, including its founder, Art Neal. Hello, Art. Great to have you back.
Happy holidays. Glad to be on here for the holiday show. That's great. I got my holiday mug to kick things off.
Yay. Thank you. Very festive. Also joining us is Terry Karabonic. Hello, Terry. Great to have you back.
Hi, Denise. Happy to be back. I do not have a festive mug, unfortunately. Aww. But it is a really big mug.
Indeed. And our shared intern, Emery Roan, is going to co-host the show with me today. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Thanks for being on the show. Hey, Art. Hey, Terry. It's been a long time.
it's been
a week.
About a week.
In addition to all of you being involved in New Media Rights, all of you are also involved one way or another at California Western School of Law, where Emery just finished up finals and where Terry and Art teach and also work in the internet and media law clinic there. Emery, I'm guessing you've been involved in that as well?
Yep. Took the class and I just finished up the clinic at New Media Rights. Was at the internship over the summer. It's a really great opportunity. If you're looking into Cal Western, definitely recommend it.
Yeah, you guys seem to definitely pay close attention to the kinds of issues that we talk about each week here on the show. I think we will start out looking at a great big case that was just decided yesterday. It hadn't really been on my radar until it hit the news via a jury verdict out of a district court in Virginia yesterday. And it's about intermediary liability for ISPs. So let's start there. It involves Hollywood. Okay, so what happened in this case following a week-long trial is that Cox, in its capacity as an ISP here, got hit with a $25 million judgment, which breaks down into $18,000 per infringement that was at issue in the case, not for anything that it actively did itself, although I suppose we can parse that a bit more, but for the acts of its users. The plaintiff here was BMG, which controls rights to works by David Bowie, Bruno Mars, Frank Ocean, and other artists. And what BMG claimed, well, first of all, BMG had outsourced its infringement activities to Rights Corp. And Rights Corp had been trying to get Cox to take various things down. And what they decided was happening and what ultimately led to the lawsuit is that Cox wasn't hitting its infringing users as hard as they would like and was not instituting a sufficiently stringent repeat infringer policy. And in order to maintain your safe harbor under the DMCA, you do have to take actions to make sure that when you know someone is an infringer, that they're not able to just keep right on infringing. So here we had a judge who got a little bit up in arms about Cox's lax attitude toward repeat infringers. There were also some smoking gun emails where Cox was saying, you know, we really have to hang on to our users. So these DMCA folks that we've taken down in the past and had to cancel their accounts, you can go ahead and reinstate them at some point down the line. So that didn't go very well with the jury. And there is now a trial court decision against Cox to the tune of $25 million. Art, tell us what you think this case means.
Well, I think this case fits well into a long line of cases that have to do with the copyright industry, as some people would call it, although I always hesitate to use that term because we work with many other folks who are creators and people that are very much copyright holders. But the copyright industry, that is kind of the large media companies, the large music companies, movie industries. Mm-hmm. It's kind of their newest effort in a line of many to make intermediaries, right? They've done various efforts over time. They've sued individual users. But one of the things that they've been doing in recent years really is much more of an approach to try to get intermediaries to cooperate with them. And for the most part, many of these intermediaries, like the Comcast of the world and even others like Time Warner, they produce a lot of content. They're kind of copyright industry media companies themselves. And so they often have been very involved with these rights holders, right? They've been willing to do the six strike policy and things like that. So this is just the newest chapter in trying to make intermediaries take more of a role of policing infringement on their networks. It's a big deal, and I think it's something to watch very, very carefully. You know, Cox as an ISP, my understanding over the years as I've seen different articles about the way Cox behaves is, you know, they haven't been quite as friendly as Comcast and others to participating in these cooperative efforts with rights holders to help them hunt down potential infringement. And, you know, Yeah, like you said, BMG complains that, you know, millions of works are being shared by Cox subscribers. I mean, we know that, of course, Cox has probably tens of millions of subscribers. So obviously there's going to be some people who are going to be using it for illegal activity. But it's really an interesting question because we don't hold folks like, you know, one of the articles I was reading about this was talking about, we don't hold Toyota, we don't hold Ford liable if people use their cars as a getaway car. And, you know, the idea of something, you know, or somebody, it's crazy, you know, to think of somebody pouring out water and then poisoning it and giving it to somebody. I mean, we don't think of somebody, you know, going after the water company in that case. It's interesting here because Cox is held liable for contributory copyright infringement, though. And I think you're right. It really centers around knowledge. It really centers around the fact that, you know, first the judge said in November, we're not going to let you dismiss this, Cox, really easily by using what's called 512A of the DMCA safe harbors. And most of the time when we're talking about the DMCA safe harbors, we're talking about 512C. Right, which is the YouTube, Facebook, where folks store things on somebody's network, and it protects those intermediaries like YouTube and Facebook from copyright infringement. But 512A is all about protecting these networks, the Coxes, the Comcast of the world, and in this case is that frontier. How far does 512A go? How much does it protect those internet service providers? And when the judge ruled in this case, back in November, that no, you're not going to dismiss this case quickly, Cox, with a 512A defense, you know, we're going to look at other things. And so when it went to trial, you know, the case really seems to center around the fact that Cox didn't react to some of these notices sent by BMG. You talked about some of the emails. I guess the issue here, I think the balance looks a little different than a lot of folks would have assumed. how it was for ISPs. I mean, the incentive now is for ISPs to simply disconnect subscribers who accounts are alleged to have been used for infringement. And there's two big problems with that. Number one, it's a really big step. You're taking away people's internet. That's number one. Number two, you know, of course, a person who's named as a subscriber on a Cox cable or any cable bill or other broadband internet bill isn't always the individual who's doing the infringement, right? And mm-hmm. so it's a really, you know, it's a really important case. I think it's gonna create this, I think there's gonna be more to it. I think Cox will definitely try to take this further. And it's really outlining the boundaries of when we're gonna hold ISPs liable or not. And, you know, it's fascinating to see. You know, I think that courts are going to try to make it a narrow ruling and say, hey, Cox, you really didn't take the steps you needed to. But I think for a while, folks have thought that ISPs, because of 512A, really did have a special status. And I do think it's really important for these, frankly, just really just basic utility pipe providers that we do provide them with pretty strong immunity. And, you know, this, I think, impinges upon that.
You know, if you...
go ahead, Emery.
I was reading the complaint, actually, and the BMG says that the they developed technology to locate the infringers by IP address and geolocation and date. But I mean, that brings up the whole other side of the issue. Is like, not only is this, not only are these utility companies, you know, vitally important that deserve protection, but you know, there's the IP addresses can be spoofed, and you know, there's no real guarantee that not only is the IP address that was indicated the infringer, but we don't even know if that IP address was the actual IP address of the that wasn't spoofed. You know, mm-hmm. So I think there's a real issue of not only how much responsibility are we going to be placing on the ISPs, but really how much efficacy, how useful would it actually be in stopping these major infringers?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised, and Terry, I want you to weigh in on this if you could, that in the wake of the copyright alert system, the six strike system that ISPs agreed to implement with the entertainment industry, that we would see a lawsuit like this. This was supposed to give the procedure for warning people and, you know, pulling the plug on them. Was a very final last resort, but giving them a lot of warnings and knowing that they were running afoul of infringement rules seemed to be the procedure there. But yet we're seeing this case where I don't know if it's just that Cox didn't adopt those procedures or that BMG decided we need more from you as an ISP. What do you think, Terry? Yeah.
I'm not sure actually if Cox signed on to the six strikes scheme, but I know even if it didn't, rights holders have been pushing for a three strikes scheme for a long time. And also one of the things they're most upset about with six strikes is they weren't actually required at any point to terminate a user's internet access. Six strikes didn't go that far, and content holders were very upset about that, but that was a compromise that had to be made. So I think this case is really an attempt to get the three strikes and you get cut off from the internet into law, which is terrifying since most of the countries that have adopted it have pulled that back, particularly in France. They had one of the most restrictive three strike schemes, but after it was abused in a wide variety of ways, including the one that always sticks with me is there was a couple going through a very acrimonious divorce. And the wife was trying to get custody and wasn't winning, so she still had access to the home Wi-Fi, downloaded some stuff illegally because it was particularly nasty stuff. She was able to get custody and get her husband's internet cut off at the same time. So there's a great, there's a lot of potential for abuse with these three letters from some rights holder and your internet goes away. And mm-hmm. so I think that's definitely a big concern. So I think this case,
It's definitely a big concern. And there's certainly interim things that can be done without taking away a subscriber's internet access. And I got to see sort of firsthand how one of those strategies works very well when one of my family members who uses an Xbox on a regular basis did something that violated the community terms of service. And rather than, you know, terminate the account or anything, what we wound up with was a suspension that I think was 12 hours long. And yeah, that drove the point home real strongly. I don't think it's going to happen again. And I think, you know, if you...
Without Halo, no.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was actually a great addition to our own parenting efforts. Let's put it that way. Nothing says don't do it like...
There needs to be some kind of DMCA system where you can send a letter to a service provider and have them cancel your kid's internet for a little bit, just for a little bit, just like an hour timeout.
Right, exactly. It works very well. And I would imagine that a similar kind of not so extreme approach would work well on the copyright front too. Again, you know, not that I am advocating that people's internet be yanked at all. During those 12 hours, you might very well need your internet access. But it's certainly something short of denying access altogether. And then what happens? You know, you've cut someone off. Maybe a concern such as what Emery raised, someone's using a VPN or whatever, and it's not actually their account anyway. But the ISP, to avoid liability like we're seeing in this case, yanks their account. And then what? Are they blacklisted? Can they get internet service somewhere else? I'm really concerned about where this goes. Do you agree, Art?
100%. I've already seen many times at New Media Rights, we've seen people come to us with really difficult situations with YouTube accounts and Facebook accounts where they've had those suspended. And that's already extremely painful. And sometimes it's a huge business hit. It's a lot even to lose one social media account, but losing your internet, I mean, it's in this day and age, we really have to think very, very carefully about going to that step, considering it is more and more the way we communicate. And so, we have to be really, really careful about just simply cutting people off. And I agree with you. I mean, although those are also, they sound pretty drastic as well. I think that certainly going with some sort of a temporary shutdown versus a full shutdown would be the way to go. But yeah, we have to be very careful. And you're right, especially for most people who have one or two providers where they are. I mean, if they're cut out of they're cut out of one broadband provider, they might not have any other broadband choice.
Yeah, that's right. A really great point.
Yeah.
Can any of you speak to what we might see on appeal from Cox here? It seems to me like they should be able to make some arguments about they are not the infringement police, right?
Well, what I would say is they're going to have to fight this knowledge element.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to have to fight this knowledge element head on. They're going to have to say why... Okay, they knew they're going to have to do the same kind of thing that YouTube did, right? I mean, YouTube faced some emails in that case. In the YouTube Viacom case, there was emails that came up about English Football League content and things like that. But YouTube was able to say, with regards to knowledge, that their knowledge was only constructive. You know, the knowledge standard is supposed to be, you're supposed to have specific knowledge of infringement. And so Cox is going to have to really show that they don't have that. The problem is that these folks, BMG, are going to point to all these notices that Rights Corp was sending them. And so I think they're going to have to attack that knowledge element head on. I mean, it's the other frontier they're going to have to talk about is 512A subject to the same requirement in 512 that says you have to adopt a policy of terminating repeat infringers, and then you actually have to implement that policy. And mm-hmm. That's to me it's pretty clear on the 512C front what it means to adopt and implement a policy. But I think that on the 512A front, at least I'm not that familiar with, you know, a lot of detail with what's required there. And so, you know, Cox might have to show that perhaps 512A was really speaking to something different. I mean, in the long run, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but, you know, looking back at the statute and looking back at the situation that Cox is in, if for some reason they didn't respond to some specific notices that they got, it's going to be really difficult for them. And, you know, it might be only that a legislative fix would be the only way to sort of say, look, 512A providers, that is the networks we use, are different than the online service providers we work with, the YouTubes and Twitters and Facebooks, and that they deserve some extra protection. But for right now, you know, when you look at the DMCA, and I you know, I went back and looked at it, was trying to see, because I always work with that clause that you have to adopt a policy of terminating repeat infringers and then actually terminate them. I always think of that clause as related to 512C, but, you know, you go back and it really, you know, so that's the thing that's in question, I think. And they're going to, and they're also going to have to, as I said, attack the basic secondary liability, contributory liability prong. The two prongs are that you have to have specific knowledge and that you have to materially participate. Usually the knowledge question is the big question. That's the one they're going to have to, they're going to have to fight. And I think they're going to have to show that they're more like a YouTube, and that they're more, they just have constructive knowledge of people are using this tool to infringe. And yes, they can use it to infringe, but there's a lot of people using it for totally legitimate activity. But they're going to have to show, like YouTube showed, that they responded quickly to notices and that they responded to notices.
Right.
Here, it's going to, you know, is what Cox did. Let's say they had some, you know, when if they had other intermediary steps, you know, will a court find that to be enough?
Yeah, excellent points. You touched on what they got tagged with, the actual claim that the jury found the plaintiff to succeed on was contributory infringement. They dodged a vicarious infringement claim.
Sure. Contributory infringement, as I mentioned, has the two-prong requirement of A, you need to have knowledge, right? And that typically means you have knowledge of specific infringing acts. And that case law comes a lot from the Perfect 10 v. Amazon case from about 7 or 8 years ago. And then the second prong of that is you have to materially participate in the infringement. So so that's really about constructive, or sorry, contributory infringement is more about what you did or what you knew and how you were involved in the infringement. Vicarious is much more what you didn't do to stop the infringement. So the way that works is it's like classic agency law. You know, these tort laws where there's a bouncer outside, and if the bouncer does something bad to somebody, is the club or the bar responsible for it? And was it within his scope of duties and all this stuff? Well, it's very much like agency law in that vicarious, you have to have A, the right and ability to control the infringement, and B, you have to have a direct financial stake in the infringement. Those are pretty specific. So, I mean, it's the classic model is a swap meet, right? Where there's maybe even more money made by selling spots to people that are selling infringing goods back in the old days, infringing audio tapes and videotapes and things like that. And maybe they get a premium. You charge them a premium because they're getting a lot of business. And so, so vicarious is really all about right and ability to control the infringement. And it's interesting because you have to have legal and practical control. Legal control is pretty easy. Like if you allow people to create accounts, then you can obviously, you do have the ability to actually cut their account off versus something like Google Images, right, where you could use it without an account. So, and then secondly, you have to have practical control. And that's the trouble here, I think, for... You know, when you go after folks like a YouTube or you go after folks like a Cox Cable, I mean, there comes a point here where is it really practical to ask these folks to police, you know, their network and the millions and millions of internet searches, the downloads and uploads that are going on every minute. And so vicarious is really much more about what didn't you do to stop the infringement versus what you knew about the infringement.
Right. And of course, all those claims played big roles in the Napster and Grokster cases where the DMCA just didn't even come into play. Let's move on to another Hollywood-related case. We've followed along with the Happy Birthday saga and who owns the copyright to Happy Birthday and whether it's in the public domain. On the eve of that case going to trial and in the wake of the judge making some rulings that were unfavorable to Warner Chappelle, the party settled. So there is not going to be a trial, but I don't think that necessarily gives us any clarity about whether we could now sing Happy Birthday to one another on this show. Do you, Emery?
I mean, I had assumed that it was over long ago. I can't believe that we're still talking about it. Mm-hmm. I guess I won't sing Happy Birthday on the show now, but maybe in a year we'll know more for certain.
Right. Well, there was a late claim in the case by the Association for Childhood Education International, which was a charity affiliated with the Hill Sisters, the women who came up with the song way back in the turn of not the last century, but the one before that. And so now they're claiming, you know, that, hey, Warner Chappelle, it's not you, it's us who received the rights. So I think, you know, there are still people out there claiming they have the rights to Happy Birthday, no matter what the evidence that came out in this case that might indicate that it's in the public domain.
I would really like to see this settled, though. I think it kind of casts a bad light on the whole industry. It, you know, when people hear that we're still, that there's, you know, very serious litigation going on over the Happy Birthday song, I think some people just sort of facepalm a little bit. And I can understand that.
Yeah, me too. What do you think, Art?
Well, I mean, I can definitely hum the song. I can do good morning to you, good morning to you, because it's still West Coast out there. I'm about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but I'll do it anyway. I think that as far as I understand, Terry and I were talking about this the other day, it looks like the settlement's going to be public. And so that, I think, is what we're going to wait and see. I mean, from Warner's perspective, the idea that they could even get some kind of settlement out of this is probably a good idea, because it's just they're just going to compound the legal costs. And if they could try to deal with many of the plaintiffs up front, I think they're probably right to do that. The real question is going to be, what are the terms of the settlement? Because they really, from everything that's come out, I mean, from the back going back to September, when the judge was talking about the lyrics weren't properly transferred from the Hill Sisters to Summy and then to Warner. And so Warner is in a very difficult position. There should be a very strong settlement against Warner Chappell. That said, it's a class action, and having been a plaintiff in a number of class actions, having been a plaintiff's lawyer in a number of class actions, you know, there are going to be, specifically in this case, I imagine there's got to be a couple of very deep-pocketed entities. Some of the folks I was talking about earlier, some large media companies who might have paid many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in license fees for the song over decades and many years. And, you know, you still do have the right in a class action. Other plaintiffs have the right to go ahead and drop out and bring their own claims. So I just can't believe that of so many people, they said there was something like they make about $2 million a year or something, which I thought was actually a little lower than I thought the royalties might be. But I'm glad to hear that people aren't paying a lot for Happy Birthday. They shouldn't be anyway. I think that there will be people who drop out of the class action and they will bring their own lawsuit and their own claims against Warner Chappell if it's not a very strong settlement against Warner. And that would be the saddest thing, would be if somehow there's some lack of clarity about whether the lyrics are actually public domain or not at the end of the settlement. So hopefully Warner Chappell will say something like, you know, we're going to say that, you know, the lyrics, at least we're not going to assert any claims regarding the lyrics anymore. And then the underlying melody should already be in the public domain. And the problem, I think, is going to be all those folks who paid a lot of license fees in the back in the past. And so I think those folks will probably bring a couple of their own individual lawsuits.
All right. Well, I think we'll make Hill Sisters our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. I don't think they've been a passphrase before, and they certainly deserve to be all these decades and decades after their creation of this song. We put these passphrases into the show in case you are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit. This will help you demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. If you need more information about that, go to wiki.twit.tv, find This Week in Law there, and you'll find our page with information about MCLE compliance for the United States anyway. And we may as well take a break. We want to get into talking about fair use and Star Wars, of course, and photographs and ugly sweater Darth Vader certainly wants us to do that. Here, let's see if we can.
Discuss the location of your hidden Christmas gift.
Oh, God.
That was amazing.
Merchandising.
Yes, we'll talk about him a little bit more in a bit. But we're going to thank our first episode, our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or run a small business, chances are your very least favorite part of doing that is rummaging through your receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I use FreshBooks in my law practice, and I'm so glad that I do. You know, we're coming down to the end of the year where you really have to get your collections in, and it is helpful to get your collections in before the end of the year, helpful for your clients to pay you by then because they get a tax benefit from it, presumably. So FreshBooks makes that very, very easy. If you have clients who've let something stay outstanding, then it sets up automated reminders so that you don't have to be the bad guy giving them a call and letting them know that they've let something slip through the cracks. But really, using FreshBooks, you hardly ever have to do that because what I find when I'm emailing out the very professional, very detailed, very accurate invoices that FreshBooks generates, that my clients pay within a couple of weeks at the outside on balance because, you know, they have that in their email. It's not sitting around in some pile of papers on their desk somewhere, and they know it's something to deal with and take care of. On your end, you'll be creating and sending invoices in minutes. And they now have a new service where you can get paid up front. You can request a deposit in FreshBooks, a retainer, as lawyers are used to collecting from time to time. No more covering the costs out of pocket or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. FreshBooks lets you organize your expenses very easily, and you can track your time almost instantly, even on mobile devices. With their automated late payment reminders that I mentioned, you can avoid those awkward emails to late paying clients. With FreshBooks automated customer reviews report, you can see all your reviews in one place, then easily post them on your website if you'd like to do that. Plus, FreshBooks just announced their new card reader. Now you can easily accept credit cards wherever business takes you, quickly and securely, right from your iPhone in less than a minute. FreshBooks card reader is EMV chip card enabled. That's the new standard in the US, and it works right out of the box. Just open your invoice from the FreshBooks app, plug in the reader, and dip the chip or swipe the stripe. You'll wonder why you didn't start using FreshBooks sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks' award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. So you need to get started right away. It's simple. It's totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law when they ask how you heard about us. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. Right, let's move into, we've already been talking about copyright things, but let's talk about some more of them. Let's start out talking about fair use and the DMCA, which we've already been on a bit. New Media Rights was instrumental in securing some of the recently announced exemptions to the DMCA. from the Copyright Office that they need to either renew or reconsider every 3 years in order for them to remain in place. Can you tell us about your involvement in that process, Art, and about the outcome?
Yes, absolutely. So the DMCA proceedings, these are really, just to start off, I guess, you know, the basics of the DMCA anti-circumvention provisions for folks who aren't familiar are that in addition to all the fun stuff about copyright infringement that you can be liable for copying and distributing and making derivative works and performing and displaying copyrighted works, there's a whole nother layer that was added in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a whole nother cause of action called the anti-circumvention provisions. And, you know, the basic prohibition is that it violates federal law to circumvent technological protection measures that control access to a copyrighted work. So that includes for purposes of fair use. So even if you want to make fair use of a work, if it's behind DRM, digital rights management, or if it's behind technological protection measures, you don't necessarily have the right to break that DRM or TPM to go get the work. And every 3 years, the Copyright Office basically forces a large group of public interest advocates, interested folks to re-argue all the exemptions to those anti-circumvention provisions. So in what circumstances are we going to be allowed to circumvent DRM to access different types of copyrighted work for the purposes of fair use? And, you know, we've been involved the last three DMCA proceedings. The ones we tend to focus on are all the, and these are wide ranging. I mean, you can't, it's so broad now, the amount of things this touches. You know, you have exemptions being argued for medical device, software on medical devices, access to your smart car, you know, your all Internet of Things type of stuff, video games. The ones we focus on at New Media Rights are remix creators and documentarians, making sure that those folks have the right to access motion picture content for purposes of fair use. And so those are really two exemptions. One is for non-commercial remix purposes, folks can access and go around TPM to access copyrighted works for purposes of fair use. And the documentarians that want to use clips of video and things like that for purposes of fair use, they can also go around technological protection measures. The one other category exemption that we always argue for is for users of mobile devices, that is people who are using smartphones and tablets, that they should be able to basically what's called jailbreak their device to be able to install software that they'd like to install. So you're not just limited to, say, you know, the Apple Store or, you know, the Play Store. So you're able to install other types of software on your device. I mean, I have very strong feelings about this process, and having taken part in it for three times, I originally set out to just bring the basic needs of the folks that we were working with at New Media Rights to the table. That's what we always try to do. The remix creators, the filmmakers, we try to make sure that their point of view is brought to the table. The problem is, and in the end, this time there were a lot of exemptions re-granted. There were some new ones for things like medical devices and, you know, and in terms of non-commercial remix and documentarians, those folks are now able to access Blu-ray discs, which they weren't before, which is good. They're able to access DVDs, Blu-ray discs, and online sources for purposes of fair use. But, you know, it's just, and also, I guess, for accessing your device and installing software that you want, tablets are now included to some extent. And so there are some small positives, but, you know, when you talk about something even like even the expansion to Blu-rays for documentarians or remix creators, you know, Blu-ray is not the standard anymore. It's 4K is coming in, much higher quality video is coming in. And I don't know if anybody, probably some people watching this, if you're a video creator or you're an attorney that's worked with somebody to do a deal, you've probably worked with a distributor, you know, the PBSs of the world, the various broadcasters of the world, they will not accept low quality video. And so for people who are trying to make a fair use and actually have people see it through some more traditional avenues, sometimes they can't even access the right quality they need, you know, to make the use that they need to make. So okay, the Copyright Office now allows you to access Blu-ray, but now Blu-ray is becoming kind of the middle tier. You know, it's not even the highest quality. And so that's kind of a more specific one. Another specific on the negative side is when you talk about something like allowing documentary filmmakers to circumvent for purposes of fair use, I think we do something that, you know, obviously we as lawyers have to, we're helping to make rules and enforce rules and we're drawing lines. And but this is one of those areas where it gets very dangerous very quickly. And it became clear to me in the hearings that we had in LA when I was testifying there that, you know, I'm very uncomfortable with these drawings of lines by lawyers of it within the film community. And there's a lot going on in the film space, everything from the way we watch these extended series on Netflix and Amazon. Even today I was reading an article that the New York Times had that was talking about the fact that maybe this is a new genre, right? Where we watch 10 episodes in short succession, and that the classic kind of model of, you know, pacing things for commercial breaks and all this other stuff has really broken down. But then you look at things like the folks we work with, they mainly use YouTube for their distribution method. And so some of those folks, I mean, of course I would argue that documentary is very broad. And, you know, yes, it's nice to have an exception for documentary, but to be completely honest, we've seen terrible uses, you know, we've seen bad uses in documentary that we help fix and make better fair uses. But you can have a bad usage in documentary. You know, a lot of reusages of footage are fine and strong fair uses, but some are not. And then, but you can also have a very good fair use usage in a fictional film. And so to say that narrative film or fictional film is somehow not entitled to the same protection that documentary is absurd to me. And we went out, and it's not just me saying that, we went out and we talked to various, and we looked at the literature that's in the filmmaking community, right? I mean, I think the normal viewer can kind of see this, like, of course, genres are helpful when we're maybe searching Netflix or something to find something to watch. But in all actuality, that's, you know, it's just a useful device for that purpose. It's not really a useful device to make laws drawing distinctions between genre. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine the first court that has to like sit there and say, oh, is this a documentary or not? And right. Of course, I'd encourage them to have a broad view of that. But, you know, we had these, what I think are, in all honesty, just completely ridiculous discussions about is a biopic or a biopic, is that a documentary or not? And, you know, all these fictional films, many fictional films now use a lot of documentary techniques, you know, cinema verite, the shaky, you know, camera.
Sure. And Modern like, Family comes to mind on TV.
Absolutely. Yeah, they look like documentaries. And so documentary-like, is a documentary.
It's so funny. It's, you know, if you look at this, it's, I mean, to make this example crystal clear, if we were talking about Selma, the 2014 biopic, they would not be able to apply for this exemption. But if we were instead making a documentary about the same exact event and just called it a documentary, then we would apply for the exemption. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really bizarre, and I mean, Art was talking about this, is that, you know, we're talking about fair use. I mean, these are artists who are arguing fair use. So if it's a fair use already, why, if it only applies to things that are going to be fair use, why are we worried about the distinction between whether it's a documentary or a narrative film? It just seems like a really weird arbitrary breakdown.
Right. Well, in your post on this, I assume you wrote this, Art, or maybe someone else at New Media Rights, but
yes,
summarizing, yes, the what happened in the rulemaking and giving your thoughts on the process, you write, if it's fair use, it should be exempted from the anti-circumvention provisions, period. So that kind of assumes, though, that anybody can determine what a fair use is before the fact. And I saw Emery just a moment ago interacting in IRC and saying, well, you can't really determine if something's fair use until a court says so. Although you guys certainly have a great resource for helping people make educated guesses about that. I love your new media rights fair use app. It operates a little like a flow chart online. We've featured it on the show before, but it's worth plugging it again. And what happens when you use this app? And it's not just for filmmakers. It's for anybody who is reusing some sort of intellectual property that they did not create themselves. It walks you through each and every one of the fair use factors and tells you at each juncture, okay, well, if that's the case, this favors fair use. Oh, if that's the case, it disfavors fair use. What it doesn't do at the end, and I understand why you can't do this, is tell you, on balance, this is probably fair use or not, depending on, you know, all the answers that you gave, because that's a really tough answer to give and might get you in trouble from a unauthorized practice of law kind of standpoint. For people interested in really getting a handle on, okay, I'm going to reuse this as part of my work, am I going to be okay on that or not? It's a great way of giving you a good guess. And I guess what I'm running up to here, Art, in the way of a question is, do you think we're getting to a point where we should be able to, and this relates to what YouTube is doing too, we're going to get to that in a second, we should be able to sort of make a good educated guess about whether it's fair use or not. If it walks like fair use, talks like fair use, we know it when we see it, it's fair use probably, that should have a legal ramification in this, whether a DMCA exemption should apply or not, or be necessary.
Right. Well, I think that's exactly the right way to look at it. That, I mean, and it starts actually really young. Like we teach people speed limits and really basic laws that they need to deal with every day. You know, people don't understand that when they're looking at a meme, right, of like Game of Thrones or something, and you know, that's fair use. Somebody's using an image from the show and they're making, you know, maybe a parody use or a commentary or something like that. And, you know, there are, every day we're interacting with fair use and every day we're interacting with copyright. And a lot of the reason that I even started New Media Rights was because we do need to understand the laws surrounding copyright. But as far as understanding fair use with regards to the DMCA, people have to consider fair use anyway because they could always be sued for copyright infringement. So we're helping filmmakers all the time make sure that they're within the bounds of fair use so that they minimize their liability and that they can get insurance for their film and all this kind of stuff. But when it comes to DMCA, Emery hit it on the head. The big issue, you know, I was talking about some specific negative issues with the DMCA proceeding. The fundamental flaw is that it's an entirely slanted playing field. You know, this takes thousands of hours from all these kind of public interest advocacy groups and nonprofits to basically argue for things that are already otherwise legal. We're arguing for a really narrow subset of fair use to be okay and allow us to circumvent for really narrow particular fair uses, and to me is just absolutely ridiculous. And that's why I was, you know, I'm so excited to see what's going on in things in places like Ecuador with talk about just making, and I was so glad to see that at least one country is considering. And I know there's challenges with international treaties and things like that, but you know, as far as I'm concerned, the U.S. should be a leader and should be setting a good example on that front. And, you know, instead we're allowing, you know, content companies and large copyright holders to simply really just waste everybody's time. You know, the smaller fix would be to say, hey, maybe you don't have to completely from scratch reprove every exemption every 3 years, which is the standard right now. Like that would be a smaller step. Maybe they could just, once they're passed, they're just like a lot of other regulations, they are the regulation, and then there can be a procedure also to deal with fast tech changes. That's one thing I was talking about, Blu-ray. Well, okay, great, they accepted Blu-ray, now it's going to be 2018 before maybe they consider 4K, and they might even say, well, maybe not quite 4K yet. And so it's just, there's a lot of problems with the three-year process and the balance, but fundamentally a fair use should be a fair use. And you know what that means though is if somebody's infringing and they are circumventing without it being a fair use, you can still use both those claims against them and they'll be held liable. But if somebody is, you know, making a fair use, then you know, then they really, they can't, because right now what has happened is that you have a chilling effect. You know, you don't have a lot of case law on the front, but here's the chilling effect. The chilling effect is you have a very strong fair use. I could tell somebody they have an extremely strong fair use when they come to us, but then they tell me, oh, by the way, I bypassed TPM, and then I look and I say, well, let's see, do you fit in any of the exemption categories? If I say no, then actually I have to tell them, you know, you're violating federal law, even though you made a fair use. And that's the problem today.
Right. We should back up and mention that what Art is talking about is Ecuador is considering a law or enacted a law. I'm not quite sure. Do you know, Art, which it is?
It looks like considering a law. It looks like it's part of a larger intellectual property rework by Ecuador.
Right. And what it would do is if something is fair use, it would give an exemption for circumventing technological protection measures. They would just be outside of any liability for doing that if it turns out that the use was fair use. Of course, there, as Art was alluding, the TPP might have something to say about that, and it's just not clear, you know, what sort of efficacy that would have if enacted in Ecuador and other countries. But it is a nice step to see. You know, this discussion is making me think of something I wanted to sound you guys out on while we were talking about the Cox BMG case. And it came to mind when you mentioned rapidly changing technologies, Art. And that is, I'm actually surprised to see this case going to trial now in today's day and age, and to see rights holders like BMG continuing to sue over infringements that involve downloading and sharing. When they're, you know, we have come to a world where I think it's a very small fraction of the population. It's not the world of Napster anymore. Where everyone's infringing. Now I'd say it's a very small fraction because they have managed to make films and music available in ways that people will actually pay for in a digital format. Is anyone else surprised to see this case? What do you think, Terry?
I wish it were surprising. I think it's really disappointing to see that I think certain rights holders have taken this policy of, if we don't enforce our copyrights to the hilt and even go to a ridiculous standard, then we'll somehow lose them, which doesn't actually happen in copyright law. And I think there's also a perception of there have been so many major wins for major content holders that they seem to have lost any ability to really look at a situation. It's like, okay, this isn't our ideal world, but is this a world that benefits our clients? And are we at a point where putting all this money into litigation doesn't make any sense? So I think we're just at a point where reason went out the window a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're just going to keep seeing these cases until someone, I think it's actually going to be some content holder said, kind of puts their foot down and says, why am I paying this much money to litigators when I could use, you know, the money I'm spending on this case for a new film project that could actually bring in revenue?
Right. And I guess part of the answer to the question is just how stringent the copyright infringement damages are. You know, their upside is huge if they can prove an intentional infringement. All right.
The technology. You know, it's been a war sort of going back and forth between the rights holders and the infringers, and, you know, the software, the pirates. But at the same time as there have been multiple legal victories against pirates, you know, I think that the technology is getting better and better for people to infringe. And there's going to be people that are interested in doing this. I think that, you know, when we said something like Netflix has like something stupid, like 30% of the entire network traffic, and Spotify and Netflix together, you know, doing huge wins for really, I think that's the way that you defeat piracy is to, you know, give a good alternative. But at the same time, you know, there are people that have been working to make, you know, Popcorn Time and these apps that are designed to make, you know, piracy so easy your grandmother can do it. And you got, you know, if you set them up with VPNs and good software. I don't really see, you know, it's like we've reached the point where I don't really see what alternative ISPs have, you know, even if they're, even if this case, you know, puts the onus on them to be doing more DMCA compliance work. I think that there's some real technological barriers to effectively stopping this. So I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting to see down the line whether or not it comes from an ISP saying, look, I can't handle this. This is ridiculous. Or if it's actually, you know, if it just becomes an unwinning battle.
Yeah, I agree. Right. And I just wanted to step in and say, I think we've also gotten to a point where the goal is zero infringement everywhere in the world. And there's no other area of law where our goal is, or where a realistic goal is, okay, we have this law, no one will ever break it, and there will never be a question of breaking it. That's not, if you go up to a lawyer in any other area of a copyright law, they will laugh in your face because that's just unrealistic. Mm-hmm. We're never going to have any law that's 100% of the time the law is in place and no one violates it.
Emery, you're our youngster on the show today. Can I follow up and ask you if you know of any, aside from being able to use a VPN and you know, conceal your identity in one way or another as an infringer, is encryption being employed? Do you know as far as
encrypting your traffic. So yeah, right, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it. You run a VPN and then you encrypt all of your traffic so that your ISP doesn't know whether you're, you know, having a personal server or downloading a BitTorrent or, you know, whatever.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you were to take Art's Internet and Social Media Law class, there's a great history on, you know, the Grokster and Napster cases and the precedent for these copyright infringement cases. And if you look at the technology behind these infringers, you've seen it really like literally evolve from, you know, Napster, where it was a single point of, you know, a single infringer with a central server, to, you know, torrents, to where we are today, where it's, you know, torrents running on the background, on the, you know, the background and under a VPN, where it's like, personally, as some, you know, I don't see how there's enough, where the ISPs go from here, because the infringing software has just been catered to fit within these legal decisions. So, you know, we have torrents where everyone is, you know, distributed it. I just think it's really fascinating.
Right. And I've certainly seen stories, and someone is bringing up in IRC right now, that some providers are blocking VPNs, just saying, if you're connecting to us with a VPN, we're not going to trust. Yeah.
There are very good reasons to have VPNs besides downloading things illegally. I think it's a really bad precedent when you have ISPs just wholesale blocking VPNs.
Yep. All right. Well, we haven't talked about this yet. It happened in November, and I want to get to it in just a second. It's a pretty important stand that YouTube has taken in what it's going to do for some users with strong fair use cases. We're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. First, though, before we get to YouTube's step that it announced, our second sponsor is Braintree. So FreshBooks is helping you get paid, and Braintree is helping your customers do their payments. Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions for free. So what you're going to do here is, maybe you're looking to become Uber or Airbnb or the next GitHub. Braintree is what you need. It's code for easy mobile payments. You should be using the same simple payment solution that helped all of these behemoths become what they are today. Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, and even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree is going to support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, YouTube. Art, tell us what they've done.
Okay. Well, are you talking about YouTube's fair use protection program?
That's the one.
Okay. All right. Well, back in November, YouTube announces this program to basically stand up to a very, very small subset of bogus copyright claims. And YouTube's going to select some very, very strong fair use argument videos and put them in the fair use protection program. It sounds like the witness protection program there. They're going to put them in the fair use protection program. And you know, they're going to back these folks up with some legal defense. They're going to give them $1 million in backing for legal defense. And so all of these things probably sound pretty fantastic so far. But now I'm going to dial it back a little bit, and you know, we can talk about the merits and the difficulties. But I got to say, you know, on its face, I was pretty excited to see this. I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's a very small step. A, because it's going to be a really just, I think, a very few amount of videos that's going to qualify. And then to put things in perspective, you know, as far as setting good precedent for fair use, I don't think it's going to do much there. Because, you know, in that, it would be great if it did, but I think that a lot of plaintiffs won't even be willing to go against these folks because they've got Google backing them, and Google's going to have some really knowledgeable people picking very strong fair use videos. So I think it'd be pretty silly as a plaintiff's attorney to pick the Google selected videos as the one that you pursue, But More specifically, as a public interest attorney and somebody who takes on a lot of clients who are YouTubers and don't really know what to do when they've had a video taken down, I have a hard time seeing when I'm going to use this program because if somebody has a really strong fair use argument now, they can counter notice. And the video is supposed to go back up. And YouTube has been for many years restoring that video everywhere. Not just jurisdictions where fair use exists, but they've been restoring that video everywhere if you do a DMCA counter notice. If you take advantage of this program, the one limitation to know about before you jump in the program, and it's fine, you can choose, but just know that if you choose the program, just be aware that, well, YouTube's going to back you up. Your video right now, the understanding is that it definitely will go back up in the U.S., but probably it'll just go back up in the U.S. and maybe a few other jurisdictions. And so that's the big challenge, is that, you know, you have a strong fair use argument and Google's going to restore you, especially if you're based in the U.S. I have a hard time understanding why you wouldn't just counter notice. But I can understand for international users, you know, why you might want to make sure that video exists in the countries that respect fair use. It's just something to be aware of, that there are some limitations. I think it's a nice step, but I would love to see, frankly, maybe even a third option where individuals who wanted to, like, let's say some people could say, okay, I'm worried about my liability. I'm worried about somebody suing me. And maybe I'll just take, if Google's going to offer me the protection program, I'll just take it. I'll only show my video in the US and a couple other jurisdictions. But a great third option would be for an individual who understood the protection program only applies in the U.S., like if they get sued in the U.S. or maybe a few other countries that have some version of fair use, like Canada and Israel, you know, maybe, you know, they understand that at least it only covers, you know, claims in the U.S., but that they would at least allow them to, you know, also counter notice, you know, or also, you know, so put them in the protection program, but allow them to actually have the video restored in other jurisdictions. And so, you know, I'd love to see something like that down the road. And I understand it's just a first step. So I definitely would applaud the move. And I would love to, I'm really excited to see how it progresses. And I just want to make sure that people who are really excited about it or think that they're going to use it, I mean, A, it's going to be a really narrow set of videos. But B, if you get invited, you might have to think really carefully, because if your video is a critical or commentary video that involves, you know, something that you're trying to speak to people in other countries about and not just speak to people in the U.S., then you got to think carefully whether you want to be part of the protection program. But a really interesting program, just, you know, glad to see some, an intermediary taking steps on this front. But and to be completely, to be completely honest, the more I read about it, too, the more I realize that when you think about YouTube's new Red program, right? That's their premium product, right? When you think about the Red program, it starts to make a lot more sense too, because many of those top folks, top YouTubers, they make fair use of things. You know, it might be a video game, or they might make some kind of use that's on the border of fair use. And some of them might get licenses at this point, some of them might not. And YouTube wants to start charge, you know, they want to start charging directly for that. And so they want to make sure that they're sort of sending the, sending a message to copyright holders that they're going to be backing up and that they need to leave some room for fair use. So I think there's something going on there too, regarding the YouTube Red product, but it's an interesting step. I don't think it's a bad step. It's just one of those steps to say, let's see how it develops. And I hope they do a little bit more to make sure those, you know, it's such a tough choice to say, okay, I'm only going to have my video in the U.S. That it makes me sad to think that the U.S. is going to be the only place that we're going to have these conversations. It's increasingly the case on the internet that people are talking about more, regionalization of the internet and things like that. But, I think it's one of the strengths is to be able to share your commentary and criticism with others in the world. And so it'd be great if Google can and can find a way to do it. It'd be great if they were leading the charge on that.
Do you think
to flesh that out, your reasoning for folks who might not be that familiar with how Red works. I take it what you're saying is it's actually in Google's self-interest to make sure the rights holders who are sending thousands and thousands of takedown notices might think twice about that, although they're being encouraged, at least in the Ninth Circuit, to do that as well by recent court decisions. But also that they have money-making YouTubers that YouTube wants to get behind and make sure that they can continue to put out their work when what they're doing also involves making fair use of third-party items?
Right. That's exactly right. I think they'll start by talking about... I mean, they have on their list of fair use protection program videos already, they have a wide variety of videos, some that have, channels that have very few followers, some that have a lot of followers. And yes, I think that their stake in the future of online video, they're really an interesting player because they have more at stake regarding fair use than a lot of other big players have. And so they, I think, have more at stake when it comes to making sure that the space for fair use is broader. But, I'm just starting to see, I was just looking at something today that was starting to talk about the connection. I haven't even totally fleshed out myself, but I think it's something to look at. And, I'm not trying to be completely cynical about it, but I think that it's something to be aware of, that there's also another benefit in there, which says that, that they might be willing to, I assume for a lot of these large channels though, where they're going to be doing original content, I mean, with all the money that's involved, it would surprise me if they don't go out and work most of the licenses. I mean, that's what the whole content ID system's about, is licenses and things like that. But I think that they might have, and honestly, there's also, of course, a good PR thing. And, whatever the reason, I think it's a good small step, and hopefully they'll continue it.
Do you think that I was just going to throw in there. It feels like to me that the underlying problem is like the DMCA process, the fact that, you can get something taken down with just a letter. Do you guys think that this is like the right first step to be taking towards DMCA reworking that? I mean, because it feels like also that this is Google and YouTube, and this is Google and YouTube volunteering to do this, not necessarily any other company that Vimeo or Facebook or any of the other, larger or smaller, UGC services. I don't know. I'd like to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
I mean, I think it could be a very good strategic first step. We have actually seen other companies stand up for its users in a bigger way. Automatica has actually been great about this. And if you're a copyright geek and you haven't read their transparency report, it is amazing. Best copyright jokes on the internet. but the YouTube program, I think, is, even though it's very narrow, I think it could be helpful in a variety of cases where DMCA reform is really struggling. As we all know, the Lens case has been going on for a very long time. The dancing baby is now the dancing child. And
dancing college student.
I think he'll be the dancing college student by the time this finally gets settled and figured out. But it's because of that case, it's become very hard to find copyright attorneys within the Ninth Circuit that are willing to take on a 512F case at all, let alone a pro bono 512F case, which is what a lot of these YouTubers would need since they wouldn't be able to bankroll a 5-year-long case. So I think this could be very helpful for that small set of YouTubers who wouldn't otherwise counter notice because the risk of a lawsuit would be too strong for them to have that backing. So I'm thinking in particular of there was a case where I believe it was either senators or congresspeople for a certain state were asking young girls who had really prepared to go speak about the importance of arts and education, just inappropriate and sexist questions. I think there could have been a real danger there in some of those individuals trying to sue on kind of bogus copyright grounds. That organization, I think in one of the statements, said they didn't want to counter notice because they couldn't afford the lawsuit. So I think particularly for US-based organizations that wouldn't otherwise counter notice because they couldn't afford a lawsuit if it did happen, and they couldn't afford to do anything with 512, it gives them that option of if something does happen in the US, they at least can have their video up and have some backing behind them, because otherwise, if these individuals counter noticed and got their video back up or without the program, they just wouldn't have access to the legal help they would need, even if the takedown was completely bogus.
Okay, well, ugly holiday sweater Darth Vader is finding our lack of Star Wars discussion disturbing.
God.
So we've got to appease him at some point here. I'm going to, along those lines, make Ray Action Figure our second MCLE passphrase for the show. And we're going to talk about that Ray Action Figure in just a moment here after we thank our third sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Blue Apron. Perfect time to be talking about Blue Apron for the holidays, either whether you're worried about cooking in your own home or whether you're looking for great holiday gifts. Blue Apron is going to cover you on both fronts. Let's face it, we all need to know how to cook. And if you're the one preparing holiday meals, Blue Apron is a great way to go because not only will you feel like you know your way around the kitchen, but cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again. But where do you start? Well, Blue Apron has you covered because for less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store, no more sad takeout. And no matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like mushroom and Swiss chard quiches with Gruyere cheese and arugula salad, or spiced roast chicken and collard greens with maple butter and thyme right in your own kitchen. Cook with ingredients that you've never used before, such as watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes. I've signed my mom up for Blue Apron last year during the holidays, and she was delightfully thrilled to receive her first box. I think it was right during the holiday break week. So it's a great way to help someone in your life enjoy their own break from grocery shopping and finding recipes and trying to decide what to make. And of course, for you, it does all those things as well. It's delicious and good for you. And right now you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for making the holidays easy and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about Ray and the fact that someone, a Walmart customer, I believe, managed to get their hot little hands on a Ray action figure that was not yet released. Some stocking error occurred, and took a photo of it and posted it in very excited fashion to the internet and to Facebook, actually. And then the DMCA claim ensued, which seems very strange, based on the fact that this was a figure that the person had purchased themselves and then made use of in ways that seemed right and proper to them. Art, were you surprised that Disney took such a hard line on this?
First of all, I guess I was a little bit surprised that there is a Star Wars merchandise podcast that is totally focused just on Star Wars merchandise.
I'm not surprised at all.
Maybe not that surprised. Although I did find out when I got home that apparently my mom has been holding a original R2-D2 in the case from the early 1980s. That was apparently a gift to me. So
wow, it's quite a gift now.
Oh, wow. I know, right? This is just ridiculous. I mean, this is the kind of overreach. It's just, we see this a lot at New Media Rights, and you know, this person was banned from posting to Facebook for a couple of days, and yeah, they legally bought this figurine apparently at the Walmart, and it's just the idea that we can't talk about the products that we search. Like, hey, did people? And when I looked at the post too, when you look back at the post, it's not just a random, I mean, it's like, hey, did we know that this thing existed? And so if he's kind of asking the question, like, did people know that this was out already? Like, what is this? I just bought this at a store. I mean, I completely think this is a strong argument for fair use. This is like, you know, it shows you again how in our day-to-day conversations about things, we use fair use, but we don't even think about it anymore. You know, people use memes all the time to communicate, but they don't think they're making fair use. You know, maybe
he took a photograph himself, right? Why would it be even needed to argue fair use?
Warn Victor on the board in the studio that much of the coverage of this has declined to show the actual photo of the action figure because apparently Rey is wearing something in her action figure garb. Spoilers. That is a spoiler. So I actually haven't looked at the photos of the action figure yet because I'm going literally right after the show to see the movie. So yeah, others might be upset if we show the picture of the action figure. I should have mentioned that before the show. Yes, it just goes to show. I think another thing that's going on here is it's not so much that... I think this is a DMCA being used for other purposes example. It's not so much that they were concerned with the copyright in the figure here. It was just a figure that had not yet been released. And
that's what it feels like to me. It feels like they're just they're using the DMCA as a bludgeoning tool to stop leaks, which is not what it's supposed to be used for. It's like textbook DMCA abuse. Like I don't see how you could make the argument that there's a copyright violation going on here at all. This is, you know, they don't want leaks. It's the lead up to their biggest movie, and they're going to get Facebook to take them down because it's so easy to send a letter, which it goes back to DMCA reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think go ahead.
Just was going to ask for your further thoughts on this.
I think this is also a really good example of why it's dangerous sometimes to use these enforcement shots. Since this didn't come from Disney, it came from a company called, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of this, Irdetto, potentially IRDETO, a company that Disney had hired to just take down stuff. So I don't know if it was just the order was take down all images of Rey that you find on the internet, and it was just done completely and without really thinking about it, which they shouldn't be doing anyways. But I think if the goal was to control leaks, there are better ways to do it, especially with super fans. Because they had to know, you know, a stocking error when you have as much merchandise as this movie has had, it's inevitable. So not going into it with what's your plan for when a stocking error shows something that is a spoiler. It seems so obvious. Just you have a letter that's from George Lucas that's all about, you know, we're so excited that you're excited about the film. Could you take this down? Because we really want to, you know, keep the spirit of the film alive. And I think fans would respond better to that, since you're not asking them on bogus copyright grounds. You're asking them to preserve the magic for their fellow fans. And if you throw in, ideally, if you throw in a couple of tickets, I think that would make the fan even happier and buy a lot of goodwill. But when you use enforcement shops like these, that discretion and that kind of creative legal business approach to problems just doesn't occur. Things just get taken down like a hammer.
Right. And apparently there was some confusion because the person who posted wrote a letter to Disney and they retracted and decided, oh, okay, we understand what happened now and you can leave your thing up. And it got reinstated. Mm-hmm. And then another takedown notice ensued. So there seemed to be one of these very common instances of right hand not knowing what left hand is doing, probably all bound up with what you were saying, Terry, that they have this outsourced to someone whose job is just to send out takedown notices. So
yeah, and we can speak with experience on that front. I mean, we see the same thing. You know, you might say that seems ridiculous. That what a joke! Like they must have really messed up in that instance. Unfortunately, it's really much more common than people think for this weird retraction and then reinstatement of a claim. Just, you know, the kind of trickery that takes place. And as Terry makes a really good point, which is that these are third parties, you know, who knows exactly what the payment is based on? You know, is it based on every takedown or whatever? You know, so they have this incentive. And just, if you're a rights holder, though, and you're out there listening to this, I mean, I think that Terry made a great point that you can win so much more goodwill than whatever kind of lost profits you might possibly tenuously allege. You can win so much more goodwill by being reasonable in this circumstance. And then in the circumstance where somebody's uploading entire sections of the film to YouTube, well, you know, you could, you know, take those down and right. focus on the actual right. infringements, right. not these kind of folks.
Exactly. These kind of folks are why we're all in a lather to go see the movie in to begin with.
Right.
So with that in mind, let's get to our tip of the week and resource of the week. We have a very good tip for you, a very practical and timely tip for you that I believe I picked up off your Twitter feed, Art, maybe. And this is the FA. Sorry?
It was me.
It was Terry's Twitter feed. And folks, you know, obviously, if you're watching the video, we're flashing up everybody's Twitter handle under their image in their lower third. And you should be following these folks. They are posting all kinds of interesting and useful stuff, such as the fact that the FAA has now required, it's going to go into effect next Monday, December 21st, that you register your personal use airborne drone. That you register it with them. And it's going to apply to a heck of a lot of drones. There, it's everything that weighs a half pound or more. And there is a complete list. If you check out our discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, you'll find all our discussion points for the show, including this piece from BGR, which concludes with the entire list of drones that must be registered. So you can check and see if you have one or not. But basically, if you have a drone that is more than half a pound in weight, I think you at least better think about it. And there's a $5 fee involved in registering your drone with the FAA that you can avoid if you do this by January 20th. Terry, anything you want to add to this?
Not really. I just noticed it because my dad picked up drones as a hobby when he retired. So I'm heading home soon to go play with the drones. So I know before we go out, before we go out and fly the drones, we're going to probably do the registration and properly label the drone together, I think was part of the plan.
Right. And this BGR piece hits the nail on the head. I'm sure there are people listening right now going, I'm not going to register my drone. They write, lest you think this is some registration you can gleefully ignore, the penalties for not registering eligible drones are stiff and include civil fines in the $27,000 range, criminal fines as high as $250,000, and up to 3 years in prison just for not registering your drone.
So. And that includes even those little parrot drones. I'm looking at the AR drones and the Bebops. Those are both, I mean, toys with cameras on them. So mm-hmm. if you're going to be getting drones for your kids this Christmas, you know, there's a really high chance that you'll have to also register it, which is, I think, an interesting precedent.
Yes. So definitely check that out. Meanwhile, we're all still cruising around on the hoverboards that don't hover and can explode, and nobody's requiring you to register those. So give that some thought as to make it, whether our laws make any sense. We have multiple resources of the week given our friends at New Media Rights. First of all, New Media Rights is an amazing resource of the week in its own rights, but we're going to point you to a couple of specific things they have available on their site that you definitely need to check out. I already mentioned the Fair Use app. A couple of other really valuable resources there are if you are engaged in not trying to make fair use of something, maybe you will ultimately need to do that. But if you want to find the copyright holder and ask for permission to use something, they have a great resource on how you go about doing that, how you start thinking about how I find the copyright holder. Terry, you posted this. Can you add to why you felt it was necessary to give some guidance on this?
A huge part of why we developed this is we've been getting a ton of contact forms, and hopefully rather than answer the same question over and over again, it probably at least 10 times a month we get this question. So we're hoping this guide at least serves as a helpful starting point for folks, since a lot of the questions could be answered by this guide. We developed it because we saw a need, and special thanks to one of our interns from this semester, Stephanie, who helped me. This guide has been on the back burner for a while, and she helped me get it out before the holidays.
Excellent. And then going a little bit further back in time, they have had a guide up on their site at New Media Rights for quite some time, since February of 2009. Though I assume you guys are updating this from time to time, on how to find free music images and video you can use or remix in your own creative works so that you don't need to worry about it's whether it's fair use, whether you need a circumvention exemption, all the stuff on this list, assuming that you read your Creative Commons license carefully, that sort of thing, may well be available for you just to use. Without having to worry about jumping through further hoops. There is a big list too here of public domain resources where you absolutely can use them without worrying about the repercussions. One of the things listed there is Unsplash that I wanted to call out and mention. If folks have not visited Unsplash yet, it's really, really cool. They release 10 high resolution CC0 photos every day. And these are some beautiful photos.
Oh, cool.
They are, they're really, really cool. They're doing a Kickstarter.
Wallpaper of, material.
Yeah, they're doing a Kickstarter of like a coffee table book of all these great images too. They're really spectacular public domain images. Anything, Art or Emery or Terry, that you want to add to this resource guide that we're mentioning?
No.
No, I think those are great. And of course, people can check out the app if they're trying to reuse video as well. The nice thing about that reuse of content, that content you can reuse guide is, as you can see, it was all broken down. Where can you get images? You know, if you're writing a blog post, where can you get video? Where can you get music to back up your video? Or where can you get music to build off and write your own song? And so, you know, if you have other resources also that you'd like on that list, it's a heavily visited list, and we'd love for you to send us your ideas. If there's something we didn't include, you know, you can use our contact form, or you can email us at support@newmediarights to you know, with ideas of things that should be on that list. But yeah, you know, definitely the whole site is full of many video written and also, of course, the Fair Use app, many different types of guides you can use. The one thing I was going to mention to folks is, I just, one of the things I didn't say, but if you're interested in this whole 1201 business that we've been talking about and making anti-circumvention laws a little more reasonable, I just heard yesterday that the Copyright Office is going to have a whole proceeding launching in the spring, or even early, maybe in January. Sorry, I'm from Southern California, so spring starts in January. So January, they're going to launch this whole they put out an NOI that had to do with embedded software, and they mentioned that they're going to do a whole study about 1201. So if you have problems with the way that 1201 works now, having to reprove these exemptions every 3 years, and you think it should just be able to circumvent for purposes of fair use, you know, you can tell the Copyright Office that very soon. And then the other thing I would keep a close eye out for, which I won't give too many details, but just a little teaser, is that Terry and I, and many of our wonderful interns like Emery at New Media Rights, have been working on a book for the last 6 months, and it's going to be coming out later in the spring. And I'd keep an eye out for that, because that will be also an excellent resource for all kinds of creators and entrepreneurs. So I hope you keep an eye out for that as well.
Great. We definitely will. Thank you so much for joining us today on This Week in Law. Terry, is there anything you want to add to what Art just mentioned of events or things to keep an eye out for as far as the work you're doing at New Media Rights?
No, I guess the only thing I would add is that if you do have a contact form for us, we're actually shutting it off for the holidays pretty much as soon as I get off this call. But we will be, so we can have a nice holidays here at New Media Rights. But if you do have questions, we will be opening the form back up in January. So if you can hold on to your question for a few weeks, we'll have the contact form back up and ready for you.
Excellent. Thank you for letting us know about that. Emery, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun. I got nothing else to add.
Congratulations. Are you done with finals now?
I am. I actually just finished arts final yesterday, wrapping up the semester, and finished up my internship with Art and Terry last week. So I think this is probably the little bow on the top of a wonderful 6 months at New Media Rights. So thanks to you guys. And
cool. And thanks to you guys for loaning Emery to This Week in Law, or sharing him with us. He's been and continues to be just an awesome help to us as well. So thank you, Emery, for spreading yourself thin and helping out two good organizations.
Right?
Yes.
I'm so thrilled to hear that he was part of your team, and he was a great part of our team for the last 6 months. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more from him in the future.
Yes. Emery, I was thinking the other day, as I finally finished wrapping all the holiday packages, that is now my equivalent of finishing finals. When the holiday stuff is done, you know.
I'll tell you what, next time, send your packages down to me. I'll wrap them. I'll send my exams up to you. It'd be a great, you know, two-way
street. I can't see anything going wrong there at all.
Nothing wrong.
All right, folks. Well, Darth Vader and I wish you a very memorable and happy holiday. We're thrilled that you could join us today. We're thrilled that all of you in the audience could join us today. If you did so here on December 18th, when we recorded, starting at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. That's when we record the show live every week. But don't worry about it. If you can't join us live, we're going to take a couple of weeks break here for the holidays. But starting back in January, we will be on every Friday at that time, and we'd love it if you can join us. If you can't, you can find the show at twit.tv/twill, where this episode will shortly be up, and our entire archive of episodes is available. You can also find us on YouTube, on Roku, and actually, if you go to twit.tv/twill, it will give you all kinds of ideas on ways that you can enjoy the show on your own time and on the device of your choosing. Sarah Pearson will be back with us in January as well. So stay tuned for that. You should get in touch with Sarah and I between the episodes. She is Sarah P at twit.tv. I am Denise at twit.tv. Let us know what you thought about what we talked about, any further things that it triggered you to think about that you think we should follow up on, any guests that you think that we should invite on, organizations you think we should be aware of and following. We'd love to hear all of that. Please do keep us in your loop and keep us in mind. And I just wanted to say a huge thank you too to all the people who keep up with Sarah and I on Twitter and other social media platforms. We have a Facebook page for the show and a Google Plus page and community. And it is so helpful. I mean, I almost take it for granted at this point, and I shouldn't do that. When people tweet to me things that they're watching and following and thinking that maybe that would be interesting for us to have on the show, it is so helpful for me. It is exactly how we plan the show every week. So please keep it up. Thank you so much for doing that. It's extraordinarily great for us and great just to have you all in our audience and following along with these very important issues with us. We'll see you in the new year. Thanks so much for watching.